Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. If there's one Christmas present that's rarely unwelcome, it's a good cookery book. Last year I was given Allegra McEverdy's Leon cookbook. I have a friend who's cooking her way through all the recipes in Ottolenghi's. I went to supper with her the other night and she was getting perilously near the end, which raises the question, what to get her next? I hope that by the time this podcast ends, I will have a better idea. To bring a bit of meat to proceedings, we interview a primatologist who argues that it is cooking that makes us human. But for starters, we look at what's on offer for the children at this most bewildering time of the year. And we start with one of those classics that no family should be without.
The Old Gumby Cat.
I have a Gumby cat in mind. Her name is Jenny Anydots. Her coat is of the tabby kind, with tiger stripes and leopard spots. All day she sits upon the stair, or on the steps, or on the mat. She sits and sits and sits and sits, and that's what makes a Gumby cat. But when the day's hustle and bustle is done, then the Gumby cat's work is but hardly begun. And when all the family's in bed and asleep, she tucks up her skirts to the basement to creep. She's deeply concerned with the ways of the mice. Their behavior's not good, and their manners not nice. So when she's got them lined up on the matting, she teaches them music, crocheting, and tatting. I have a Gumby cat in mind. Her name is Jenny Anydots. Her equal would be hard to find. She likes the warm and sunny spots. All day she sits beside the hearth, or on the bed, or on my hat. She sits and sits and sits and sits. And that's what makes a Gumby cat. But when the day's hustle and bustle is done, then the Gumby cat's work is but hardly begun. As she finds that the mice will not ever keep quiet, she is sure it is due to irregular diet. And believing that nothing is done without trying, she sets right to work with her baking and frying. She makes them a mouse cake of bread and dried peas and a beautiful fry of lean bacon and cheese. I have a Gumby cat in mind. Her name is Jenny Anydots. The curtain cord she likes to wind and tie it into sailor knots. She sits upon the window sill or anything that's smooth and flat. She sits and sits and sits and sits, and that's what makes a Gumby cat. But when the day's hustle and bustle is done, then the Gumby cat's work is but hardly begun. She thinks that the cockroaches just need employment to prevent them from idle and wanton destroyment. So she's formed from that lot of disorderly louts a troop of well-disciplined, helpful Boy Scouts, with a purpose in life and a good deed to do, and she's even created a beetle's tattoo. So for old Gumby cats, let us now give three cheers, on whom well-ordered households depend, it appears.
That was Irene Worth reading The Old Gumby Cat from T.S. Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, published by Harper Audio. It all goes to show that old cats never die. They just slink off to their next life, as this particular feline favourite has done with a new edition illustrated by Axel Scheffler. With me to discuss this and other Christmas treats for children are Julia Eccleshare, our children's books editor, and Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website.
Hi.
Now, Julia, when I was looking for this latest edition on Amazon, I noticed that there are two others also still in print, and one is Nicholas Bentley's rather elegant one from way back in 1940, and the other is Edward Gorey's rather sinister one from 1982. Why do we need another one?
Well, interestingly, why do we need a very cuddly one, you might have asked, is a great contrast to either of those two illustrators, because Axel Scheffler's illustrations are very soft compared to either of those. But I think that's rather good. I think it brings it straight into children's lives in a way that certainly I remember when I was introduced to those poems, I always thought of them as madly adult. I never really thought they had much reference to me, and it was only much later when I saw the musical that I really realised the point of them. And I think young children can enjoy them hugely. And I think having the younger illustrations will draw new audiences in. It's really important to keep repositioning some of those classics and make them seem like they are brand new for a new audience. Mm. And all children know Axel's illustrations from The Gruffalo. So they're already a long way along the line. And then they get that brilliant language and the jokes. The jokes are just so fantastic in those poems. And so the parents have the pleasure of reading them aloud and the children feel totally comfortable because they're looking at little cats that they already feel they know because they're kind of similar to The Gruffalo.
Mm. Sarah, is this one you'll be getting?
I don't know, really. It's all new to me, actually. I've bought copies of Old Possum for sort of older children of my acquaintance, but it wouldn't have been something that it would have occurred to me to get for a younger child. But as Julia says, it's possibly the case that because they're so familiar with Axel Scheffler's drawings from all the Julia Donaldson books, that it is a nice way in for them. So, yes, quite possibly.
Now, reimaginings aren't always popular. I remember an excoriating review we carried of Lauren Child's new illustrations for Astrid Lindgren's Pippi Longstocking, notwithstanding which I have it in my cupboard and I have never been able to give it away because I think it's so wonderful. Tell us a bit about that, Julia.
Well, everybody else loves that. And again, you know, Lauren Child is a very iconic illustrator of now. And again, because, you know, her Charlie and Lola books are on telly, a lot of children, a huge number of children, have a sense of what her visual images are like. And so it's a very easy hop. And then Pippi Longstocking, who is anyway a timeless heroine. I mean, she really didn't perhaps need to be repositioned, except that if we're always arguing that, you know, that children's books are kind of less easily accessible than lots of other media for them, we have to make them at least look like something that they're going to feel comfortable with. So, okay, they've been growing up on Charlie and Lola on telly. Then they see these lovely Lauren Child pictures. And then they think Astrid Lindgren has been, that Pippi Longstocking has been freshly written for them. Mm. I think that's really good.
Mm. It brings up quite an interesting issue, doesn't it, about parents and children reading together, where the parent's memory is completely different to the child's.
Yeah, but the parent's memory is the same in the sense that, I mean, it's different in the sense that the actual pictures are different, but it's the same in the sense that they've been looking at pictures which would have been exactly appropriate for them. So they see in the pictures of the editions they looked at little girls who were exactly like them then. And, you know, the contemporary children are seeing images that they feel are right and contemporary for them. I think it's very good for children's books to be re-illustrated. I like it.
Now, Lauren Child, she's got a new picture book out as well, hasn't she?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I have to point out Pippi Longstocking was a couple of years ago, but you can still get it.
Absolutely.
The new one, tell us about that.
Well, the new one is a very moral tale, and I think it's a very timely tale for all parents who are so blinking protective about their children. And basically what it's about is an over-pampered poodle who isn't allowed to do anything, but of course, like any sensible person or poodle or child would, yearns for the life of the rough and tumble, and she wants to be out with other dogs called Growler and Butch and things like that. And her owner doesn't think she should do those things, and of course the poodle takes matters into her own hands. And there's a wonderful scene with the poodle on the psychiatrist's couch, which only Lauren Child would sort of realise as brilliantly as that. But it's very, very witty. And Lauren's commentary on life is always absolutely spot on. I mean, she arrived in her very first picture book with Clarence Bean. She arrived being able to give us a very fresh insight into just how bizarrely we all behave.
That's like Call of the Wild for young children.
Yeah, well, she jumps in puddles and does all sorts of naughty things. Now, there's been a bit of a rebellion in Guardian Towers this Christmas about Horrid Henry, who's another naughty person.
Yeah.
Parents saying that they don't actually want their children to shove whole cakes in their mouth and spit and things like that. What, Sarah, are you one of these?
Well, my child is under two, so he spits and shovels whole cakes in his mouth as a matter of course. So it's not something that I've actually come up against yet. I don't know. I guess it's with all great children's literature, or certainly the children's literature that I remember being great, things like Roald Dahl, part of the appeal is the transgression, the fact that it's doing the things that you're not allowed to do, and you like it because you don't want your parents to like it. It's like, you know, if you're a teenager, you don't want your parents to be listening to the same music that you're listening to. So it would sort of defeat the purpose if the parents all thought, how brilliant, I must buy this for my child. This is what he needs to learn how to grow up. So, you know, I think probably if parents are rebelling, then it's doing its job.
But look at Pippi Longstocking. She was a rebel.
Yes.
I mean, you know, she lives alone without any parents at all. So I suppose that's easier because at least there's no sort of being nasty about parents. But, you know, I agree with Sarah. I think children's books have always been full of this. And actually, the interesting thing at the moment is because we're now not allowed to frighten children, look at all the fuss there is about where the wild things are, what we've gone for is instead of sort of scary, we've gone for repulsive in one way or another. So we've had, yucky.
Yeah,
well, we've
had
a long period of Horrid Henry, which is one kind of repulsive. And we've now gone into Mr. Garman, Grubtown Tales, and Mr. Stink, the new David Walliams title, you know. And I think we're taking, I mean, children want to be, I mean, Sarah's point is right. Children want to be subversive. They don't want to be doing books that adults are interested in as well. So you've got to find some angle for that. And if you can't be scary and nasty, I mean, you know, frightening of the children or of the adults, you have to find other ways in. Roald Dahl, of course, did both.
Now, there's an extraordinary new book called Duck, Death and the Tulip. Where does that fit in? Tell us about
Dark Death and the Tulip is really a very adult picture book. It's about a duck who is, as it were, stalked by death and then first forms friendship with death, and then in the end death carries it
it's
off
very
essentially
scary.
It's not scary exactly. Children love death. I mean, do you remember Posy Simmons' book Fred about the cat that dies? And you know, she said partly she wrote it because so many children did pet burials and all of those sorts of things. Children like, they're interested. They're the ones who, when the gerbil dies, wants to look at it,
yeah,
and hold
Judith
it and all of those
for,
things
said that to Mog,
with Mog
as well, didn't she?
It's a very important thing to do, and why not have a children's book about death? It's sad, but it's appropriately sad, and it's actually quite amusing about how you can kind of, you know, survive and then you in the end do die.
Well, death is a skeleton in a dressing gown. I thought that was really creepy. It's published by a little New Zealand publisher called Gecko Press, which has only recently started to import things. This is sort of quite an original form of publishing, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is. It is. But, I mean, it's, you know, the wonderful thing about children's books is that breaking of barriers, you know, doing something different and giving children a fresh view and a fresh way of thinking of things, and actually making parents stop and think about why are they not letting their children know about death. Mm. You know, it's
so
good.
So now moving on to older children quickly, give us a few titles that people should be looking at. What are the outstanding titles of this year?
Well, I think it's been a good year for teen fiction, and I would mention very quickly Mal Peet's Exposure, which won the Guardian Children's Prize this year and is a wonderful, very accessible teenage book based on the Othello story and exposing the problems of celebrity.
And you can read that as a standalone, or you can then go back and read the two previous.
Yes, but it isn't. There is a character linkage, but it's not a trilogy in the sense you have to know the previous stories. Yeah, so you can start with that. There's Terry Pratchett's Nation, which is a fantastic. Really, it's a sort of explanation of heritage and nationality and kicking over the traces, and it's been turned into this huge production at the National Theatre. But it asks interesting questions. I mean, Terry Pratchett writes hugely good stories, but he does also pose very interesting questions sort of underneath that. One of my favourite books of the year was a book by Judy Blundell called What I Saw and How I Lied, which I think is a brilliant title. I think that How I Lied is so clever. And it's a kind of, you know, modern version of Rumour Godden's The Green Gage Summer, because it's how a teenager completely misreads the situation around her and falls in love with a con guy, really, and fails to notice that her mother's in a relationship with him. It's so clever and it's so kind of cool.
Mm. Now, Sarah, you're particularly into poetry, and that's where we started, so that's where we should end. Give us a few examples of poetry for children. Does it work for children?
Poetry for children is a really interesting area, and I think that interest is actually the fault of the publishers, because there seems to be a temptation to talk down to children when you introduce them to poetry, and it's always the tactic that people seem to take is to make it funny, which is just, it's completely unnecessary, because if you think about it, often the first literature that children encounter are nursery rhymes. And children aren't scared of poetry in the way that adults are. They have no reason to be. In fact, if you give kids something with a rhyme and a rhythm, they'll love it, which is partly why Julia Donaldson, I think, has been such a huge success, because she's so good at that. So what I'd probably recommend is not so much the funny books, of which, you know, if that's the route you want to go, quite a good one came out earlier this year, Twinkle Twinkle Chocolate Bar, which is an anthology. It has quite a few poems by Michael Rosen, who's also a poet as well as a children's author. So, you know, that's one option. But really what I'd go for is just a really lovely big anthology. And Usborne brought out a nice one a couple of years ago, the Usborne Book of Poetry for Children, I think it's called. And then again, if for very young children, you can go down the Twinkle Twinkle Chocolate Bar route, or what I again would probably prefer to do is just get a really great big compendium of nursery rhymes. And there was a great one from many years ago, decades ago now, the Orchard Book of Nursery Rhymes. And you'll find everything in that you remember yourself from your childhood, and all the echoes and half-remembered rhymes. For older kids, the book that actually kicked off my own poetry addiction, and the one that I'd recommend, that I always do recommend to parents who are trying to introduce their children to poetry, is a book called I Like This Poem. And it was done for the Year of the Child, which I think was something like 1988. And my mum bought it for me one Christmas, and I spent the whole Christmas reading it. And it's sort of poems chosen by children, then grouped by age, and then the children have brief sort of notes at the bottom saying, I like this poem because it does this, it does that. And I can remember half of the poems out of it. And it's fantastic, a lovely introduction to kind of the world of poetry. And because it's chosen by children, they don't think about what children would like or ought to like. They think about what they actually like. So the range is fantastic. So that's what I go for.
So one of the things that comes out of this is that actually the things that you read as children are the things that you remember for the rest of your life and treasure for the rest of your life. It's very important what you choose for your child at Christmas. Thank you both very much for coming in. We'll put a list of the books we've mentioned today on our website at guardian.co.uk/books. Now, one of the books that certainly seems to have brought the foodies out in force is Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human, by the British-born, Harvard-based primatologist Richard Wrangham. Absolutely fascinating, said Nigella Lawson. How exciting to see a distinguished scholar proving unequivocally that cookery is at the centre of our humanity, said Sam Clark of Morrow. Packs the punch of a tornado Rossini with the lightness of a foam infusion, said fast food queen Allegra McEvedy. We'll be hearing more about them later. But first, Richard Wrangham explains to Richard Lee why it is that our ability to braise, broil and bake are what differentiates us from our distant cousins, the apes.
I find it now astonishing that people have not thought more about the consequences of cooking, because in evolutionary biology, what really matters is your ability to get enough energy to spread your genes, to reproduce faster and to survive better. And it turns out that cooking gives us a tremendous amount increased energy compared to eating our food raw.
How does that work?
Well, there are two big mechanisms. Digestibility is how much of the food goes through your body and actually gets digested. And the assumption is that all our foods get digested because that's we cook our foods. But if you don't cook them, a lot of them just don't get digested at all. They pass through to the end of your small intestine or all the way out of your body without ever being digested. The second factor is the cost of digestion. We normally pay quite a lot in terms of the energy that we use to make stomach acid, to make enzymes, have the muscular action, to squeeze the food along our intestinal tracts and so on. And the softer the food and the more finely processed it is, then the quicker it moves through the gut and the less we pay. And this turns out to be amazingly significant. I mean, you can take two groups of rats and in one case give them hard food and the other give them soft food. And the ones that eat the soft food, even though they eat exactly the same number of calories and pay exactly the same in terms of locomotion, nevertheless end up, before they're adult, as heavier than the group eating the hard food, and with 30% more body fat.
So there's this mysterious missing gap in terms of the energy that you've got if you eat food that's raw versus the energy you get if it's cooked. What importance does that have in terms of evolutionary biology?
Well, the moment that our ancestors would have invented cooking, then they would have acquired a lot more energy. Exactly how much we don't know, but maybe 50% more. And at that point, those individuals would have started having shorter interbirth intervals, and their babies would have survived better, and they would have had more energy to put into the immune system to help themselves survive better. So evolution would have favored them very dramatically.
What kind of epoch are we talking about here?
The reason that we are able to exploit cooked food so well, and by the way, we cannot exploit raw food nearly as effectively as any other animal, is because we have small guts. We can trace when we started having those small guts. It was about 1.9 million years ago. So this inference from biology takes us into a much earlier time than is normally thought. It's often thought that cooking arose as an invention sometime in the last few hundred thousand years, which would be very odd because that's a time when nothing was happening in human evolution.
So what exactly is going on at 1.9 million years ago? Are we at a stage of Neanderthal man or of Homo erectus? Where are we in the kind of grand scheme of things?
It is the origin of Homo erectus. Homo erectus was the first species that looks like us. Before then, before Homo erectus, we had a species that's variably called Australopithecus habilis or Homo habilis, and that's a species that was about the size of a chimpanzee, and it had a great big jaw and great big teeth for eating all its foods raw. Then you get to Homo erectus, which looked like us, and all of a sudden the mouth has become small, the teeth have become small, the brain has become bigger. We've got a body form which is like ours in the sense of having small guts.
And the size of the teeth, the size of the gut, the size of the brain, they're all connected, you think?
I do indeed. The only organ that is significantly reduced in us is the gut. And this is true of primates in general. Primates with small guts have big brains. We have the smallest guts of all in relationship to body size. We have the biggest brains of all in relationship to body size.
So there's some kind of cultural invention, some kind of transformation that changes the size of the gut, the shape of the jaw, the kind of time scale that is involved in terms of getting enough energy to survive. And that is the thing that drives us to become human.
That's right. One of the things that happens at that point is that we stop climbing. We lose our relatively long, beefy arms and big shoulders for being able to haul up into the trees. And that fits in rather nicely because, obviously, in order to cook, you have to have a control of fire. And the reason that you would have wanted to be able to climb prior to that time is to sleep in the trees safely. But once you have fire, then you can defend yourself against predators. And probably that was the reason that they controlled fire in the first place, or at least it's a perfectly plausible guess. And then, of course, you have the chance episode of somebody dropping some food in the fire, picking it out because they're hungry all the time, they want to eat it, discovering it tastes nice, and then humanity gets going.
If you're right about the importance of cookery in our evolution, in the development of being human, what does that mean for us today?
It reminds us that cooking is something to which we are biologically adapted, which means that for the relatively small number of people who have chosen the lifestyle of eating raw food, they should not think that this is natural, and they should therefore be somewhat aware of the health hazards. Now, that is a very small number of people, but for the larger number of people, I think once you start investigating the significance of cooking, you realize that food processing affects the number of calories that we get from our food in a way that is completely unrecognized by the food standards agencies.
So you're saying you get more out of a Big Mac than you do out of a steak?
Exactly. That's right. If food is ground as well as cooked, then you get more out of it. And our current estimates of the amount of calories we get out of food does not recognize this. And it means that if people really took the table seriously and tried to construct a diet based on those calories, then in some places they could really suffer. I mean, raw foodists would die if they ate a diet that was composed of 2,500 calories of raw food as shown in the typical tables. And people could then sue those agencies and say, well, you did this wrong. So, you know, if we want to be serious about our calorie counting, then we need a new system.
Richard Wrangham talking to Richard Lee. Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human is published by Profile. So, we cook, therefore we are, using our opposable thumb to turn the pages of Nigella or Jamie or Gordon or, goodness, it's all so confusing. Thankfully, our very own John Crace is on hand to digest a soupçon of Delia's Happy Christmas.
I first wrote a Christmas cookery book all of 19 years ago. So, why do it again? First, most of you will have forgotten about it by now, so it's an obvious way to cash in with little effort. More importantly, though, Christmas has been rather hijacked by Nigella in recent years, and her extravagant excess does not sit comfortably with today's austerity Britain. In times of hardship, you need a down-to-earth brand you can trust. Me! Christmas lasts for 8 days, so the provident cook needs to have a set menu ready for 40 meals. Here I have listed a typical daily example. Breakfast, roast collar of bacon. Mid-morning snack, potted venison tureen. Lunch, roast bronze turkey. Tea, souffléed Arbroath smoky creams. Dinner, fillet of beef in pastry. If you're lucky, however, several members of your family may die of a heart attack long before the 8 days are up, meaning you can cook less thereafter.
Another money-saving tip from Auntie Delia.
That was a digested read of Delia's Happy Christmas by John Crace, which you can hear in full on guardian.co.uk/digestedread. Well, joining me in the studio to help work out what to do for the best is Susan Smiley of our food and drink site, and Sarah Crown's still with us. Susan, that was John on typically excoriating form. Do you think he's being fair to poor old Delia?
Oh, yes. Well, far be it from me to disagree with Mr. Crace, but I do think he's bang on the money in this one. Especially at this time of year, lots of food personalities will rehash books and bring out new publications. We've seen quite a few this year from Jamie's America, Delia's new Christmas book, obviously. who can blame them, really? I guess, you know, there's a market for it. Delia's Christmas Books, best-selling food and drink book on Amazon this week, and has been for some weeks, I think.
Do you think that the big-name cookbook is coming to the end?
I hope so. I mean, I think there's a move away from that kind of celebrity title and lifestyle book and a move towards serious cooking this year. I think it might be a bit of a depressing thing to, well, I don't know whether it's depressing or cheering, but to think that there's a trend towards cooking maybe tells you a lot more about the state of cuisine in this country than anything else. But I think there has been a move towards kind of people want to learn to cook. They don't necessarily want to kind of hear what the big name chefs are telling them necessarily. They want to some books that have been doing really well this year are sort of a book called Mince by Mitzi Wilson. It's a typical example of the kind of book that people are kind of really grasping because it's got lots of information in it. That I think that's what people want now.
Is that the sort of book you'd be going for, Sarah?
Yes, probably. I'm not a very good cook. And when I want a cookbook, I want something that is going to give me the basics. So, for example, I entertained all of my family hugely last Christmas by saying, after Christmas dinner, I know what I want for next Christmas, which is a great big fat cookery book from Fiden called The Silver Spoon, which is a sort of classic of Italian cookery. And, you know, it teaches you how to do everything, you know, roast the perfect chicken, make the perfect soup. And that's ideal for me because I can't be getting on with really fiddly recipes from Jamie Oliver and Nigella and this much cream and this much sugar. And I just want something that'll teach me how to make a meal. Which I can, you know, I feel like I'm impugning myself a bit here. I'm not totally terrible, but that sort of basic is what I'm after. And yeah, mince sounds pretty good. I eat a lot of mince.
What about going out and collecting mushrooms and things? There are a lot of books about foraging and things at the moment, aren't there?
Yeah, there's been some really nice titles this year. There's the Forager's Handbook by Miles Irving, which it's kind of really the antithesis of that kind of lifestyle coffee table book. It's kind of a hefty big book. It's crammed full of information, you know, it's not full of pretty pictures, but then it's about foraging, which is an area that you really need to have confidence in your source. It's a really good guidebook, good reference, tells you what to find, where to look, and importantly what to avoid, which when it comes to foraging, you know, I kind of don't really care so much about pretty pictures. I want to know that there's a reference that I could trust so I don't kill myself.
I do remember going blackberrying with my brother, who came back with a basket full of deadly nightshade. But anyway, we'll move on from that. He's still alive. And what about this thing of provenance? I mean, there's an awful lot about sourcing food properly, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a movement for some time now, I guess, away from organic and towards local. And some books that have been interesting this year are books on game, which you can't really get more free range than game. And Tom Norrington Davis and Trish Hilferty have brought out a really lovely guide. It's a subject that intimidates a lot of people, game, I think, and it does a lot to kind of make it much more accessible. It dispels a lot of the myths around game. Actually, Norman Tebbit brought out a game book this year as well, which apparently is very good. I haven't used it, but I've heard good things about it.
I think John Crace digested that as well.
So what about food as travel? Since fewer of us are going to be going abroad, will more of us be eating our way around Europe or indeed the world?
I guess so. I mean, there's been a kind of long-standing fascination with Italian cuisine, and River Cafe have brought out I think this year the classic Italian cookbook, which lots of us who have a serious interest in food will already know the River Cafe collection, and lots of that's kind of republished in this book. But there's a really interesting book out this year by Jose Pizarro called Seasonal Spanish Food, and I think that's hopefully going to do for Spanish cuisine what dozens, if not hundreds, of spokespeople have done for Italian cuisine. And you can kind of see the importance of that book when you think that it was launched about a month ago now at the Spanish Embassy. It's a lovely book. It's kind of got, obviously, lots of recipes, lots of background, lots of sections on Spanish cheese, the sort of well-documented Spanish love of the pig and you know, how important rice is in Spanish cookery. And it's a really nice book and one I'd recommend. Mm.
And there is, of course, can be an exoticism in things closer to home, can't they? Tom Jane in this week's Saturday Review writes, It saddens me that so few English cookery books eschew the modern mishmash and multicultural blend. All the more reason, therefore, to greet Peter Breese's account of traditional food in Shropshire with rousing cheers. He'll teach you to stuff a boar's head, a wake-up call after long nights of risottos, chowders, salsas and tortillas. There's a man who's sick of life, isn't there? Julia, just very finally, is this an area that you could think of buying stuff, buying books for children?
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, and Osborne have just produced a really lovely book about Christmas cooking, which is obviously always going to be, you know, popular and easy to do because it's a time when people are in the kitchen anyway. And there's a very good teenage cook called Sam Stern who is very interested in food himself, and he genuinely does the cooking, and he does promote recipes for the kinds of things that he would make for his mates. So yeah, I think it's a great area for children. In fact, I just wish more children did learn to cook. And I mean, unfortunately, the best way of learning to cook is to watch somebody else cook, but if you haven't got a parent at home cooking, you're never going to see that.
So Sarah, take note, you're the only one with a child young enough at the moment to actually learn from this. Well, are there any other good Christmas cookery books that we've overlooked? Let us know your favourites on our podcast blog. We'd also love to hear your suggestions for book highlights of 2009, and in fact the whole decade, for our Christmas review programme, which you can hear next week. The address is guardian.co.uk/books. That's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Susan, Sarah, Julia Eccleshare, as well as Richard Wrangham and Richard Lee. Until next week, I'm Claire Armistead, and the programme was produced by Scott Corley. Goodbye.